Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Max Alexander, CEO of the hit experiential movie spectacular phenomenon, Secret Cinema.
Then we'll be discussing the timeless qualities of print and the futility of all human endeavour with artist Stanley Donwood.
And as a new documentary celebrating the life and work of Toni Morrison hits cinemas, we'll be delving into the legacy of one of America's greatest writers.
All that coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news, all that and more ahead here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are again. Org, what a delight. Sunday lunch with Macellari, as I write it in my diary. Here we are for a, I'm going to go big and early, a scintillating Monocle Weekly ahead.
Yeah, it's going to be great. How many Yorkshires do you think you'd like this week?
Certainly four.
Four. Yeah, yeah. A handful. I think we've got a great show on the horizon, on the near horizon, coming up quite close, actually.
What about the recent history, though, Org? You've just jetted in, specially almost for the weekly, from New York City. You've been feasting on the Big Apple. Any particular delights, cultural or otherwise?
I went up to Deer Beacon, which is an arts centre just outside the city. It's upstate, which is my favourite bit of New York, actually, going up the Hudson River, which is very, very wide, by English standards, tremendously wide.
It's a big body of water.
It's a large one. Further up, you get to Hudson Town, which is a remarkable place. They used to haul whales all the way up from the Atlantic, harpooned old Moby Dick and his pals, to be rendered down there. Now it's full of antique shops. So, you know, I suppose that's kind of gentrification. Deer Beacon is something of a... Well, it's very American. The art they have there is very American.
No, you surprise me.
It's very big. Lots of big sculptures by men, which, you know, is good and bad. Rough and smooth, as you like to say. Some big Richard Serras. Do you like Richard Serra?
I like a little bit of Dick.
I like a little bit of Richard Serra, but only a little bit. And unfortunately, he only comes in big bits. What have you been doing, Tom?
Well, you know me. Very much always at the coalface, not swanning around global citizen.
Gallivanting,
like you.
Yeah.
Here on home turf, working hard, making sure we are broadcasting Monocle's message, always positive, upbeat, looking for avenues of opportunity around the world. However volatile times, whatever the everyone else is banging on about, we've got our own voice and we stick to it. That's what I've been working on. I know another signature voice, one that sounds and rises out, sends a calm message around the world, even whilst others are losing their heads. A man who always keeps his. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that night. The
stars were bright, Fernando. Welcome, Faye.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
You do have a very calming voice.
Oh, that's great to hear, actually.
And a calming, I'm going to say a calming demeanour, generally.
Would you say mien? A calming mien.
Calming mien.
I can get it. Do you notice?
Who's calming mien?
Do you notice when I'm angry sometimes,
yes,
or not?
Oh, good. I do, yeah. Because I share a desk with you, Faye.
I've never seen it, Fernando.
My boyfriend tells me that it's through my face that there are some very little things that you can notice.
Oh, you're a frowner.
A little bit.
You've got to tell, yeah. As if we're in a poker game.
They're exactly. Called microaggressions.
Oh, I have a lot of those.
I don't know if they're micro. What have you been... You're looking ahead to next week's news.
Yes, and don't worry, I will start on a kind of a negative note, but it will end well.
So we're heading towards the sunlit uplands.
Absolutely.
Okay, where are we starting? Down in the low valleys?
I mean, again, I know very much our approach through coronavirus, but I mean, it has to be noted that it is affecting the cultural scene as well. It was on my list, I mean, if there was no coronavirus, that the London Book Fair was going to happen this week, and so the Leipzig Book Fair as well, which are two very relevant, you know, events for the industry. So they're not happening anymore. And this week we found out that No Time to Die, the latest James Bond, is going to be postponed for November. But you know, on a positive note, you know, the industry is kind of looking what they can do. And for example, even with the James Bond film, I think it's a wise decision because, you know, that's the kind of film they need to do well in China. So of course, you know, it makes sense to postpone a little bit. It's a big blockbuster. So now we have to wait and see about the upcoming cultural events, and there's one in mind as well, Eurovision. People are
don't
already
you
talking
worry
about it.
Your trip to Rotterdam, Fernando.
Exactly.
I'm
well,
sure
it's
all going to go ahead.
I
think this is the point. There are expedient, sensible, pragmatic things to do. More danger can be done by the panic than by the virus. And I think that sort of thing. It's very much business as usual. Like I mentioned earlier, we're sticking to our guns, aren't we?
Well, and it's so much business as usual that I decided to do two film releases in France. Because I was reading, someone told me, cool, we don't have James Bond, but perhaps it would be a good time for smaller films as well. And I decided to not to be too Anglo this week. So in Paris, there'll be two French comedies. Again, that's the kind of French film that doesn't get exported very often. We have all the serious dramas, you know, the very art house hits. But I think that, you know, at that time of so much stress in the world, there's two releases that I quite like. The first one is Les Bonnes Épouses, How to Be a Good Wife, which is the latest comedy by Juliette Binoche. I mean, I've saw the trailer. She plays like a headmistress in, of a French school in the 60s, and France is going through all the kind of the student protests. It looks quite nice, and Juliette Binoche is always great. But again, I hope it's going to be released here in the UK. But what a bad translation! How to Be a Good Wife?
Is it knowing, perhaps?
Perhaps.
I love a good French farce. Bloody love them. A lot of them get remade, don't they? Like Horrible Bosses, or no? What was it? Dinner for Idiots was originally Dîner de Cons.
Oh, let's go to Paris then and watch Les Bonnes Épouses. Or there's another one for you guys, Une Sirène à Paris, which is about a man who, you know, he finds a mermaid and fall in love by the Seine River. And again, you might look, oh, this could be just a trashy comedy. It looks quite beautiful in French. The visuals are amazing, I have to say, because I couldn't really understand what they were saying all the time.
Yeah, yeah, that's the problem with French films, isn't it?
I like to pretend that my French is good.
But surely you can read le sous-titre.
Why would they put subtitles on a French film for French people?
What else have you got for us?
Let's end on a good note. I mean, usually I don't like those sort of dates, but, you know, I'll explain why I like this one. It's the White Day in Japan on the 14th of March. It happens 1 month after Valentine's Day, because apparently in some countries the tradition on Valentine's is for the women to give chocolate to men. But then after a month, the men return the favor and they give marshmallows back. And that's why it's called White Day. And again, I was doing some research. Oh my God, maybe it's an old Japanese tradition. No, it isn't. I mean, it was created in 1978 by their National Confectionery Industry Association. And for those who don't like marshmallows, white chocolate is very popular at the time. And that's why I decided, because I love white chocolate. I'm not a woman, though. But, you know, I can still buy it.
I hate white chocolate.
I'm not a fan. Can I tell you a chocolate-related story?
Sure.
My brother is a school teacher, and for World Book Day, which I think is global, as the name would suggest, everyone dresses up in literary outfits. And he, as an English teacher, has to do it. And so he decided to dress as Willy Wonka. Good pick. The kids like it. So he ordered the outfit, but owing to, I guess, copyright restrictions, the actual name of the outfit that he had to buy was Adult Chocolate Man.
Fernando, thank you as ever. We'll see you next Sunday. I'll bring you a big bag of marshmallows. You at home, listener, are with the Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be hearing from Secret Cinema's CEO, Max Alexander.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs programme. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
In one of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Launched in 2007, Secret Cinema has been a great success. Its immersive take on the silver screen, delighting the imagination of people who want to be part of the very fabric of films of yore, from Back to the Future to Dirty Dancing.
Back to the Future, when 2006 looked like a million years away, didn't it, Tom? Secret Cinema is also expanding internationally with plans to go to the US later this year and a multi-title agreement with the Walt Disney Studios. Monaco's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Secret Cinema's CEO Max Alexander to find out more about the work and plans of what is fast becoming a cultural behemoth.
It's kind of a unique evening, and the words immersive and experiential and live and all that are used so often that they've sort of become devoid of meaning and they've become glib. But Secret Cinema, the performance differs from almost any other kind of event because we invite our audience to be key participants. We don't really have any bystanders, and it doesn't matter whether all you want to do is put a hat on and eat noodles and dance in the rain or run around like lunatics, fully immersed, participating in every adventure, going on every treasure hunt. You've got to play your part. You've got to be present.
Well, absolutely. And I love the curation. I mean, because, you know, they're very different choices. I mean, you had Moulin Rouge. I mean, currently you have the, you know, the TV series Stranger Things. Yes. How is this process of curation? Because you have to keep it interesting, right? It's not just sci-fi or it's just not comedy or something like that.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's probably the funnest part of the job, actually, is being able to sit in a room with amazing creatives and just go, what should we do next? And because we've got such deep and long-lasting relationships with the studios, we've now got to a place where, while you can't simply have everything, you can have a very grown-up conversation with the owners of these wonderful stories and ask them to license them to you. So we definitely try and counter-program is the theatrical terminology of it. So if you do a dystopian sci-fi, you know, first show, then the next show you want to have something that's a huge ensemble song and dance number, and then a bit of adventure, and then a bit of a fantasy. Funnily enough, actually, we find that our audience are quite up for everything. I mean, once you've first tasted what a really, really amazing, you know, intense but ludicrously unpious and democratic and accessible night out tastes like, then you want them all. You want them all. We're very untitle driven from an audience perspective. We just don't want our audience to be bored.
I completely agree. And I would definitely not going to be bored with your next one, which is Dirty Dancing, which premieres in summer,
July,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. How are the workings for that one already?
So it's actually, Dirty Dancing is a remount. So we produced that show 4 years ago, and it was a, you know, huge, riotous, you know, mad ensemble dance party. And so we've taken the original bones of the show and, you know, added more events, more cast, more dance-offs, more music. This is one of our outdoor events. So it's, you know, thousands of people a night. The last one we did was Romeo and Juliet, and we had 2,500 people turning up as Capulets and 2,500 people turning up as Montagues every night. And these, on the surface, very normal people spent the evening doing rap battles and dance-offs. And, you know, they're fab shows.
And I presume, you know, with the incredible success of Secret Cinema, your budgets are getting higher as well, I mean, compared to the previous ones. And I think that's incredible for, especially when there is such a sensorial experience, as we may say.
Yes, you're right. I mean, some people think that we're like Smaug the Golden sitting on this vast amount of money. But no, we invest almost everything in the shows. And for us, the kind of cultural integrity of the product comes before everything. Again, that's why
it's a success.
That's why it's successful. It's why the studios love us. We really try not to cut corners. And indeed, with some of our shows, we sort of ludicrously overbuild it. But no, it's the most important. The most important thing is the quality of the show. And, you know, really, we think about, you know, profits as something that will naturally follow, rather than the point of we don't start with that vision.
And Max, tell us about the relationship with studios, because you guys have a deal with Disney.
Yeah.
This is massive. What does that mean for Secret Cinema?
It's an amazing deal, and we're really privileged because we have a deep relationship with Netflix, owners of Stranger Things, deep relationship with Disney, and they're real collaborative partnerships. And in practical terms, what it means is that over the next 3 or 4 years, we will write 3 or 4 large-scale Disney shows, and we'll take them around the world. In terms of our business, it's unbelievably exciting to take the stress of having to do a transactional negotiation out of the system. So again, we have a much more collaborative and strategic relationship with Disney, which means that, you know, we don't have to search around for opportunities. There's a huge back catalogue, and
yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. The catalogue's amazing. It keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Marvel, Lucasfilms, Buena Vista, Searchlight, Disney, and Fox.
Wow, that's incredible. What about international expansion? Of course, it's a British brand. Mm. You've been already to China, now you're going to the US later this year?
So we took Bond to Shanghai last year and learned an awful lot about cultural sensitivity and how you move these large-scale, almost unique formats around. Very sadly, we've had to go dark for a few months because of the coronavirus. Mm. We intend to open a show in LA later this year, and we hope that's going to be Stranger Things. And then, you know, our focus over the course of the next couple of years will be to take these amazing shows that we write in London and move them to various large cities in America, but also to tour them. So the shows like Dirty Dancing, which are great outdoor festivals, they lend themselves, you know, it's being put on trucks and following the sun around the United States. So that's the plan for a couple of years. What could possibly go wrong?
And it's interesting that a British brand, one thing, you know, I'm not from here, I'm from Brazil, but one thing that people don't know perhaps about the Brits, they do like a good sing-along in a way.
Yeah.
I think for some reason, musicals tend to do very well here and kind of those experiences more than perhaps in some other countries that I've noticed.
So
is that the case?
I think that's probably true. I mean, actually, funny enough, in America, people are far more disposed to go and dress up. And so things like cosplay and live action role play and, you know, Civil War costume days out are incredibly popular. If you've ever been to America for Halloween, you'll see that the entire nation seems to lose its mind for 30 days.
Yeah.
So yes, I mean, our cast are very good at provoking song and dance. And we try and create the conditions in our shows where play is inevitable. So no one is left in the corner. And
not even baby.
Yeah, not even baby. No one is left in the corner. But it's so unthreatening. When you're invited to dance on a stage on your own, that's quite threatening. If there are 5,000 people with their hands in the air in an environment where the cast are also provoking and inviting you to dance, it's almost impossible not to. When we did Blade Runner, we made it rain. We not only built the set and lit it and had this extraordinary audio scape that reflected Ridley's original show, but we brought weather inside. And so people went from hot London to dark, rainy, noisy, dystopian LA. And some people just came and took their umbrellas out and just danced in the rain for 3 hours.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to do.
And again, looking at the numbers, I mean, I remember seeing perhaps a few years ago that just because a film is on Secret Cinema, you can land yourself the top 10 UK films in the week. That's impressive. And how does it work? What time? Because, you know, for those of our listeners who perhaps never been to one, so you pay for the experience. And is it usually an evening one? How many days a week?
Oh, for sure. So it's evenings, Wednesday through Sunday, and then we'll have a matinee at the weekend. It's really what the audience make of it. So if you want to come, you know, for an hour and a half and run around and follow your favourite characters, I say, or eat noodles or whatever it is, then you can do that. If you want to stay for 6 hours and end the evening with your head in the base bin, then, you know, we love those people too.
That's amazing. And it's usually a secret location as well. That's the kind
I think it's one of the things that we are going to... I never think that the secrecy around the location is really that important, fun enough, because we want people to be able to plan their evenings and also get there on time. So, I mean, the secrecy really is, we don't want people to reveal any of the, you know, the amazing events of the night. But also, the secret is really your own trajectory through the evening, because none of our shows are scripted. All our actors are completely imbued with freedom of will, and our audiences frequently create their own shows by connecting up with each other. The secret really is your own trajectory through the evening.
Amazing. And tell us more about, you know, I know you have the deal with Disney, international expansion, Dirty Dancing in summer, but what else can you tell us? I mean, especially with this deal with Disney, that doesn't mean that all your
Disney. You know, the wonderful thing about Disney, as we said, is you could just, you know, you could serve Disney and no one else and you would never get bored.
Mm.
I mean, we want to be respectful of catalogues that are owned by other partners, but we also are really interested in other formats. So, you know, we'd love to take an album or an artist and build the world of his or her music.
Wow.
Which we've done once with Laura Marling, and we think that video games are a really interesting opportunity as well, because the creators of video games, particularly the big elegiac titles like Red Dead Redemption or Grand Theft Auto, they have the same initial challenge that we have, which is, how do you make a grown-up pretend?
Wow.
And so, you know, the world is not short of stories. I mean, it's a golden age of storytelling. The Oscars were incredibly wide in range and type, and the studios have been supplemented with Amazon and Netflix, and they're writing $60 billion worth of checks to originate content. The theatre is in rude health. There are more books published than there ever been before. It's not the availability of stories that's problematic. It's finding congregational environments, you know, temples where audiences can consume these stories together and then be released. You know, the Greeks called it catharsis. It was about being released from the story in order to reflect upon it. And, you know, the problem we have now actually is that the stories come at you, you know, through your devices in such an extraordinary pace that you're on the tyranny of the next up, the tyranny of the eternal scroll. We make you put your phone away, you play your part, and then when you go home, you think a little bit about what you've just done.
Absolutely. And another thing I would like to ask, by the way, you mentioned the Oscars. I can totally imagine a Secret Cinema Parasite special.
Oh my God, I saw that last night. It was one of the most extraordinary films.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
And for example, I would love to see one of Jaws or A Nightmare on Elm Street. Here I am. I'm just
kidding. Come, just throw the ideas out.
Yeah.
But you're right. So I would love to do, we're really interested in doing smaller horror formats. You can't do 5,000 people as a horror story because you only need one person to laugh and the whole magic is...
Exactly. Do you have one that you would love to see it, even if it's a bit far-fetched?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, okay. Don't tell anyone. I would really love to do Titanic.
Thanks to Max Alexander talking there to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And do keep an eye on Secret Cinema's website for a look at what they've got coming up. It's secretcinema.org. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
For a global perspective and some fresh ideas direct to your door on business, culture and design, not to mention fashion, travel and much more, subscribe today and join the world of Monocle. As a valued subscriber, you'll get a 10% discount in all Monocle shops and our online store. You'll also be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events and have full access to the magazine archives. In addition, all one-year subscriptions come with a free limited edition Monocle tote bag. With four bespoke subscription packages to choose from, you decide what suits you and your lifestyle best. What are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today.
Time for a bit of music, Tom. What do you reckon?
Oh, yes.
Great. You'll remember this lot from the first time round. It's the Avalanches with their new single, We Will Always Love You, featuring Blood Orange. Since I saw you last, there's been many a sunset. You told me to break it. Seems like a week. Golden thought you see. You and I were to him when we first met. I don't even understand. But every day we're apart seems like a week. Draped in monotony. My life got in me.
We Will Always Love You from The Avalanches featuring Blood Orange. Good choice.
Thanks. Dan Rickwood, better known under his artistic alias Stanley Donwood, is a bit of a Renaissance man. An artist and writer, he's best known for his work with Radiohead. Since 1994, should that be 1994...
Don't... That doesn't make any sense. You're actually disproving your own fucking stupidity.
I'm happy to disprove my own stupidity.
The year 1994.
Since 1994, he's produced all the artwork for their releases.
Through typography, illustration, paint and woodcut, he's built a stunning body of work. An instantly recognisable visual language. Recently, he's worked with nature writer Robert McFarlane, contributing drawings to McFarlane's haunting, lyrical, prose poetic exploration of a forgotten corner of Suffolk.
Stanley's latest book is Bad Island, a silent linocut exploration of the macro history of an unnamed and unfortunate island. Told exclusively through the printed image, it recounts a story that resembles our contemporary crisis of the Anthropocene. I sat down with him to learn more about the book and began by asking him about some of the rather doomy adjectives with which people were describing it.
I'm sort of trying to sort of acknowledge and respond to the sort of reviews and comments and things that people say about it. I quite like just doing that, just a word, pick a word out.
Yeah.
Also sort of, I guess, almost semi-consciously trying to encourage people to use even more despairing words in their descriptions.
Progressively more and more despairing.
Yeah, we'll see how bad we can get.
Bleak and scathing were the two that stood out. When you set out to put this book together, you were just telling me that it's taken about 2 years. Mm. Were you going for bleak and scathing?
No, not really. No, I didn't really have any plan. I started cutting the first liner cut and then I did another one, and I was really enjoying it till I got to about 8, and I thought, I'm trying to make a book. It's going to take a lot more than 8. I'm trying to do something more than a pamphlet, you know. So I sort of made up the story as I went along, so I didn't know what was coming.
I was interested in that. When I think of lino cuts, obviously you can kind of patch them here and there and you can repair them, but there's something very final about a print to me.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The show that's opening tonight is the actual liner cuts, and there are no patches.
No patches?
No.
No need for patches.
Just all the mistakes are there.
It's not the case, then, that this sort of laborious process, which you were telling me you conduct kind of in solitude,
more or less.
Yeah. It's not the case that it eliminates room for spontaneity.
I don't know. It doesn't eliminate it because I don't know what they're going to look like. I start off with a blank piece of linoleum and then a chisel and start. You know, and then when it's finished, it's finished. I don't know what's going to be in it. It sort of builds itself because each one takes, I guess, say roughly 12 hours. Over those 12 hours, sort of anything can happen. You know, I can draw anything with the chisel, so more or less.
This book tells a sort of wordless story that's kind of the story of the Anthropocene, really, isn't it? The arrival of the Anthropocene.
In a way, yeah. When I was doing it and before, I was reading books by Jared Diamond and Noah Yuval Harari, who wrote Sapiens. And, God, what was that? Another book called, I can't remember the author, but it's called The Earth After Us. Have you seen it?
It's fantastic. Yeah, I love that book.
And it's a kind of very big rebuke to human overweening hubris. Because despite everything we've done, all of how great we think we are, all we're going to leave in the geological record is a really almost microscopically thin layer of a higher than usual rate of extinction. That's our fucking legacy.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
That's quite a grim cocktail of reading. I went through the same phase. I read Sapiens and then I read Earth After Us. It does leave.
I can
you
recommend Collapse by Jared Diamond.
There we go.
If you want a trilogy of cheeriness,
abject misery.
Yeah, and there's also The Uninhabitable Earth, which I actually read when I was just about finishing this.
David Willis Wells.
Yeah, that's a particularly good holiday read.
I want to get onto the kind of themes that those books kick around, as it were, and that are sort of explored in Bad Island. But before we do, I was going to ask, you're known for your work with Radiohead. You've done all that album art. You work across various different media, drawings, paintings, lino cuts. You also write. If we focus on the visual stuff, how do you see the difference between, you know, making an album cover versus drawing an illustration versus making a painting? What's the job of each different thing and how do you approach it?
I don't really know how to answer it. I kind of choose a different whatever medium I end up using for whatever it is that needs to be done. At the moment, I'm working on an artwork for Glastonbury, and that's a painting. And I'm sort of planning that out. So I plan painting a little bit more than I plan, say, a liner cut. And a drawing is quite a spontaneous thing, sort of pen and ink or pencil. So it really depends how I kind of think what the end result needs. I don't know. It's very difficult to explain. But I've not really thought about it.
What about in the approach? You know, I was interested about what you think an album's cover art needs to do versus... What does it need to communicate versus illustration?
I'm kind of so old. I remember going into record shops and like choosing records on what they looked like because I was basically too shy to go and ask the cool people behind the counter. I could listen to it on the headphones. So I started off with, you know, a record sleeve has got to grab attention from a distance. You know, there's loads and loads of pictures in a record shop, as was. And somehow you've got to shout or do something odd enough to make people want to pick up that picture. And once people have picked something up, you've hooked them a little bit, not necessarily properly, but it's like picking up a book in a bookshop. So with Bad Island, I was like, can we just have the cover just slightly embossed? So when people pick it up, they're kind of something, it's not just looking, they've got a sort of like tactile sensation. And I guess so they think twice about putting it down. They're kind of, oh, what's this thing? So I kind of think with record covers particularly, it's just like grab attention.
That point about the slightly embossed cover, I mean, it is very tactile and it does, I mean, it also kind of reflects the lino cut, which has such a kind of idiosyncratic look to it. The lino cut, I always think, you know, like woodblock prints, they kind of exist outside time, don't they?
Well, all of this, I started working in this style of lino cutting, which I kind of slightly disparagingly call quasi-medieval, because I had a book of the woodcuts that went with the Nuremberg Chronicle, and that was published in 1493, and that was supposed to be a kind of history of the world and all the kings and everything that had happened up to that point, 1493. And it was obviously printed, published in Nuremberg, hence the title. But they didn't have a travel budget in those days. So everywhere, wherever it is, Babylon, Jerusalem, Paris, London, everywhere looks a bit like medieval Nuremberg. And also, it looked like they'd sort of done it, they were being paid on piecework, you know, one eye on the clock, the other eye on the door, which I really liked, that sort of, just get the job done, let's get out, you know. So I've kind of tried to do that. As an argument, it doesn't stand up because it, you know, took me 2 years, so I should have used some computer program or something. But anyway, so I took that medieval style and I've kind of run with that for the last, God, ages, since about 2006, I think.
But it works so well when you're using it on this kind of material. I also saw online this big lino cut of a kind of Ballardian vision of a drowned London.
Oh, yes, yeah, that was London Views, yeah. And it's, that was the first thing I did, yeah.
You know, there is something of the kind of pestilential sort of Old Testament.
Yeah, well, it was actually in this collection of the woodcuts from the Nuremberg Chronicle. There was one of the fall of Babylon with these sort of almost comedy toppling towers and one of Sodom or Gomorrah, and someone's, is it Lot's wife turned to a pillar of salt, and these cities were being destroyed by God. But they had these kind of like op art waves and these curly cues of flame. And I was just like, I'm having that. That looks great. So I'm working on a massive one of Paris being destroyed in a quasi medieval style at the moment. I'm a bit worried about the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
With a chisel and lino, I don't know. It's going to be challenging.
Well, at least you've got lots of source material for Notre Dame.
Well, yeah, the Notre Dame is the only building I'm not going to have on fire. Good. Because it's a little bit too tasteless even for me.
We have mentioned these books that are maybe popularising a sense of general futility and hopelessness around the kind of human experiment.
Yeah.
And these ideas. I was interested that you made them into a book because it seems like when you think too hard about them, they're kind of a very enervating, these ideas that
they are.
At the end of it all, there's only a layer of extinction and microplastics.
It's a very nihilistic kind of point of view. But on the other hand, is it possible to think too hard about the human condition? I don't think it is. There's a lot at stake. I think it's almost criminal just to read self-help books and to life-affirming memes and stuff like that. I think we should think long and hard about what we're doing. because I'm beginning on another project, again with Robert McFarlane, and it is to do with the insect apocalypse, so-called. And I've been speaking to entomologists about this to get some background. And I spoke to a guy called Dr. Ed Turner from Cambridge, and he said the thing with extinctions is if you've got a dodo, say, or a woolly mammoth, it's really easy to make them extinct because they're big, they're slow, there's not very many of them. When you get to insects, there's loads and loads of them. They reproduce really fast and they're really, really quick. And we're killing them. So if the insects are in trouble, we are in big trouble. So I'm like, a little book about the end of the world, man. If that brings people down, good.
It's what they deserve.
Yeah, right. It's what we all deserve.
You spoke about that working with Robert McFarlane, and I was, again, looking online at some of your work. I was thinking about this kind of renewed interest in, quote-unquote, the land, which I think makes sense because certainly in urban spaces, a lot of the decisions that have been made, a lot of the policies that have managed how the countryside is run, which people in the cities have been able to cheerfully ignore for the last sort of century, are now having an impact in the cities. People are starting to think about sustainable agriculture practices and things like this. But there's also something more, there's like a cultural tie that seems to be building. I saw this little painting with the Cerne Abbas giant that you'd done in the background, and I've seen that Cerne Abbas giant in quite a few places recently, in kind of Jeremy Deller designed streetwear and another streetwear label called Heresy.
Just using like, that, really?
Yeah, yeah. And it's cool. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing image. But I was just thinking about like this sort of, you know, from a kind of Extinction Rebellion perspective, it makes sense that we're attached to these. What the country is, it's kind of cultural fabric or something. Yes. But then it's also,
I'm a bit nervous about that, all of that blood and soil thing.
Well, this is exactly my point.
It's a very fine line that separates some deep ecological thought from a sort of tendency towards a sort of eco-national socialism.
Right.
This series of paintings I'm doing of these, what they call sacred sites in the Great British Isles, which I'm not going to be exhibiting on the Great British Isles. There won't be, because I don't want to be associated with, so they'll be exhibited exclusively in Europe.
Very good. So that's the way. It's how you contextualise your interest.
Well, yeah, this was a sort of drunken afterthought, you know, because I was painting these pictures, and the first one was the Uffington White Horse, which was done, you know, I started painting that. I must have started that in about 2011 or something. So well before the referendum and all the hideousness that's followed Cameron's, wow, I don't even know what to call it. It's a historic error.
It is a historic error, but it'll still only be a layer of extinction and microplastics.
You're right, so it's all going to be okay in the end.
Thanks to Stanley Donwood, and Bad Island is out now, published by Hamish Hamilton. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, Tom Edwards and Augustine Macellari in the chairs. Toni Morrison, who died last summer, was surely one of the most important writers of the last century. Her powerful, beautifully written books centred the experience of African Americans in a literary landscape that looked decidedly pale. Beyond that, however, her works speak as masterpieces in their own right, lyrical, insightful, and always resonant.
Now, Morrison's life and work is being celebrated in a new documentary, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. As the film hits the silver screen, I sat down with Dr. Tessa Roynan, a teaching and research fellow at Oxford University who specialises in African-American literature, to learn more about Toni Morrison's impact and remarkable legacy.
I think one of the most important things about Toni Morrison is that she did write over such a long period, like nearly 50 years. So there's always a changing context. So her first novel appeared in 1970, The Bluest Eye. And that was only just as the civil rights movement was coming to its end. And she herself had a hand in bringing many black authors to publication and to light. But there weren't really yet any black studies departments in universities. And she really felt with those early novels that they were being misread and misunderstood. I think in the film she talks about a review of Sula in the New York Times, which said, gosh, this is a good writer. She should stop writing about black women in the Midwest and she should write about something really important and significant. So it's quite hard for us now to think back to 1970 and what a very different world she was writing into. Different in some ways, though, I think she'd say, because she would say that some things have improved over time, but others perhaps have gone backwards or might be horribly the same as even that pre-civil rights moment that she visits in novels like Home back in the 50s.
I wrote down that quote, funnily enough, to kind of discuss. She says, the kind of liberal reviewer says, it's a shame that she's limited to writing about black people. That's, from here, seems like pretty open sort of white supremacist criticism. How much of a part did she play in shifting the paradigm away from a society where it seemed acceptable to write something like that?
I think she played an enormous part in placing the African-American experience at the centre stage, pointing out to people there really wouldn't be any American history, let alone American literature, without the African-American history and without that experience. What would it look like and how integral African-Americans had been to every stage, not just of the literal building of Washington, D.C., for example, but all the art forms that are most cherished that have come from the U.S., whether that's jazz or rap, etc., would not exist without African-American culture. And she also insisted that that culture be moved, you know, from the margins to the center and be seen as the absolutely integral thing that it always has been. So she really recalibrated American culture, I think, and did the same for black literature. Obviously, there were endless debates about whether black American literature should be taught on its own in very large quotation marks, sort of minority field, or whether it should be part of the American canon. And she did a huge amount in her teaching and literary criticism to sort of look at processes of canon building and show that African American literature had a rightful place along with Moby Dick or F. Scott Fitzgerald or all these other so-called canonical novels.
I wondered about that kind of codifying of black literary culture, as it were. Did she kind of slot into a pre-existing literary tradition, or was she one of the early mainstream figures of it?
Well, I think the question of Morrison and literary tradition is incredibly interesting because her own reading, as she would tell you, in her undergraduate and master's degrees were actually all in the Western classics, Shakespeare, Faulkner, Joyce, canonical writers. But then she was not only part of a tradition in the 70s of this kind of Afro-American women's renaissance, so people like Paula Marshall or Alice Walker. This was also the time when other black women writers who'd gone out of print, like Zora Neale Hurston, believe it or not, or Nella Larsen, were being rediscovered in the 70s and reissued. And until that time, they'd been pretty inaccessible. She sort of played a part in reinvigorating a past tradition, and she was also part of a new wave of black writing.
At the beginning, she also discusses this experience she had when she was writing on the pavement with a pebble with her sister. She starts writing a word that could turn into fun or it could turn into something else. And she describes the way that her mother came out and very, very frantically took the pebble off her, said, "You've got to clean this up." And she said this was the moment that she recognised that words have power. Where do we see this in her work? Is it present from her first novel, this kind of knowledge?
I think she absolutely has that knowledge that language is an incredibly powerful tool. Writing can change the world. The Bluest Eye begins with a primer, like a literacy book that was given to children to teach them to read, like Here Is the House. And it takes apart this primer, the way that it constructs the value of white dominant culture. And that text sort of literally falls apart as The Bluest Eye goes along. It loses its punctuation. All the words merge into one. And both in the things she was dismantling and in her own creative innovation and different use of language, she was absolutely attentive to the absolute power of language to shape reality and change the world.
because she did have this capacity to be kind of experimental, but at the same time write these incredibly compelling, beautiful, image-rich stories, isn't she?
Yeah, I'm always struck by the number of things she could do at once. So vast epic historical sweeps that make us see history in a new light and bring forgotten stories to the centre stage. And then that psychological realism as well. Extraordinary lyrical voice, like in Jazz. Jazz is such an important novel, by the way, where the form is exactly mirrored to the kind of political and social things she's wanting to say about the relationship between the individual and society and how kind of American individualism has got it wrong. And there could be a different way of interacting. And she absolutely maps her literary style on the jazz aesthetic in a really breathtaking way.
How important was it to her to complement her writing with activism, with kind of participation?
I think that she felt that for her, her writing was her activism. I mean, I personally haven't seen, you know, images of her out on demonstrations or crossing the bridge in Selma, Alabama, etc. But she was incredibly active in promoting the writings of civil rights activists. So Angela Davis, Huey Newton, Muhammad Ali. And I think that that was probably no mean feat from Random House in the 1960s, and that she took plenty of hits for that. So for me, that's more activism than most of us get to in a lifetime.
When we think about her legacy and the influence that she had on subsequent generations of writers, do we see them picking up the themes that she had, or do we see the people who are working most strongly in her tradition, her spirit, picking up newer, more contemporary issues and wrestling with those?
I think she would like to think that there were new and different issues, but as I say, she was very alert and very prescient or prophetic about, say, someone like the appearance of Donald Trump as president and this wearying sense of Groundhog Day when it came to race and equality. So you could say that her works really anticipated the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. There's a really interesting novelist from Mississippi called Jesmyn Ward, who's very much influenced by Morrison, writes brilliant novels such as Sing Unburied Sing. Probably in quite a Morrisonian way, she's kind of new and the same, so sort of reinventing traditions, borrowing a great deal from what's gone before, but doing new things at the same time.
I wonder if you think that she had some success through her work in shifting the kind of expectations and the value systems of audience, to go back to that review that she cites in the film, whether it was thanks to her and obviously to her peers that audiences perhaps now can recognise that as a ludicrous sentiment.
I think she did have a great part in shaping our perceptions. And it's really interesting when you go back to early interviews she gave on the page as well, how much the world has changed to a great extent for the better. In that film, there's a really interesting interview with a white male interviewer, I think, for TV. And she says something about, I think it's Sula challenges the master narrative. And he queries this phrase, the master narrative. And she does a really amazing job of explaining what that is, without pulling any punches, without backing down whatsoever, but very graciously, in this utterly charming way, you know, explaining to him in a way you couldn't fail to understand what a dominant culture is and how it feels to be fighting against that. And I don't think that someone now would say, what do you mean by the master narrative? I think, or I hope, that we've shifted to the point where people know these sort of forces or these cultural processes are at work and they need to be resisted.
Yeah, quite. That's sort of something that I think one sees in Beloved as well, that uncompromising but also gracious way that she outlines the real monstrousness of this system of oppressive exploitation that helped establish America and kind of helped lay the foundation for its sort of 20th century success. Today we see quite an angry and rightfully angry rejection of the need for explanation, of patience. People, I think largely social media fueled, people expect that maybe one should just know why something is bad without it having to be explained. And it seems like that makes sense. But then conversely, the pushback comes in the form of these movements like the alt-right, where you have maybe white men who say, well, where are my prospects? Why should I take it for granted that I'm privileged over a different sector of society when to me it seems that I'm not? Do you think that that patience, that graciousness that you described there, do you think that that's something that maybe people could learn from a bit in the kind of social media age, that's something that could endure from her work?
What I think we could all learn from Morrison isn't exactly patience, but it is that willingness to explain up to a point. So she's incredibly good at seeing the complexity of things, which is never excuse or a condoning of some evil act, but she'll look at a full picture and see 2, 3, 4, or 5 sides of something. So whether it's Cholly's awful attack on his daughter in The Bluest Eye, or why the Garners' supposedly kind version of slavery in Beloved is more complicated than we might think, she'll really look into the how, the whys, and the wherefores of things. That's not the same as saying, you know, black people should endlessly be explaining themselves to a white or oppressive culture. But I think she makes things difficult and complicated as they are. And she expects a lot from us in listening and following. And I suppose one thing that's a bit regrettable about the way she appears in social media is, of course, her beautiful language is reduced to quotations, sort of empowering quotes for this or that, when actually her novels demand exactly the opposite reading. And I have to say, what I particularly appreciated about this film was it was incredibly slow and detailed in the best possible ways, and it spent a lot of time with different interviewees or with Morrison letting her speak, letting her explain complicated things that actually with race and history you can't reduce them to sound bites. And this is a film that really paid tribute to her gift to see complexity and nuance.
Thanks to Tessa Roynan and Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am is in cinemas now. There you have it, Augustine. Light and shade, as we promised at the top of the programme, and a delight. Always good to talk literary luminaries, and we had the delights of the silver screen as well, and a few other little meanders on the way. Classic fare for Sunday lunchtime.
It is indeed. I'm happy with that. It was a nice little selection of people from across the spectrum of business and the arts, which is really our remit. Tell me, Tom, which is your favourite Toni Morrison book?
Org, I couldn't possibly choose. It's like being asked your favourite child.
And which secret cinema iteration have you most enjoyed?
Again, the same. I'm sure we'll have more of the same right from the very top drawer of radio at the same time next week. See you for edition 559, Org. But for this week's iteration, that's all we've got time for.
I produced today's show, but more importantly, our studio manager was May Lee Evans.
The Monocle Weekly, we'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augustine Macellari.
Goodbye and thanks for listening.